differential geometry review, or that's what it's supposed to be. So I'm Matt Johnson. I'm a faculty member here half the time and half the time at York University, which is in Toronto. My research area is cosmology and gravity. So when I say differential geometry review, really what I mean is, what kind of stuff do you need to know to understand the most exciting things about cosmology and gravity? Okay. So I kind of hope that these four lectures give you enough of the tools and perhaps imparts upon you at least some small fraction of the excitement that I have for these topics to really get into them and understand the mathematics and understand how to do some real problems. So differential geometry. Why geometry? Well, I'm sure you've heard it said before that gravitation can be described by geometry. That was the insight of Einstein. And perhaps you've seen this equation written before. Which is Einstein's equation. I'll write it up here. So we'd like to understand how to unpack this. This is this deceptively simple formula. In reality, is a set of coupled partial differential equations for something called the metric tensor. And the metric tensor basically tells you how space is curved. It tells you about geometry. And if you're not familiar with the notation, there are these indices, okay? And these indices imply that this is an equation for the components of a set of tensors. Okay, so in order to truly unpack Einstein's equations, we have to have some understanding of this object called the metric tensor. We need to know what tensors are. We need to know how to manipulate tensors. And because Einstein's general relativity is a theory of space-time, we kind of need to understand a little bit about how space and time are combined into space-time. And again, that relates to this object called the metric tensor. So pretty much that's the goal of these four lectures, is to figure out how to unpack this equation, understand how to manipulate the various pieces, and understand the concept of tensors. So before we get there, maybe I'll just spend a few minutes describing why this equation is so fantastically interesting and what you can do with it, at least from a very biased personal viewpoint of the things that I find interesting. Okay, so in words, what this equation tells you, on the left-hand side, we have quantities associated with geometry. So these R's, so this is the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar. And this basically tells you in kind of an abstract way, if I have some geometry and I look at a point, how curved is that geometry around that point? Okay. Now, in order to curve geometry, we need to put something there. Okay. So you've probably seen the animation of like a bowling ball on a big rubber sheet. So this is the rubber sheet, and this is the bowling ball. So this is matter. And this tells me maybe I have some particle at that point on the geometry, okay? So this equation basically tells us how the geometry responds to the presence of matter, okay? And then there's sort of an auxiliary equation, which isn't quite Einstein's equation, but it's more like an equation of motion, say, for the matter. So we still need to know how matter responds to geometry. And for particles, that's given by something. So we've got Einstein's equation plus if we're talking about particles, we've got the geodesic equation. If we really want to describe Team U Nu and its dynamics, if we want to describe the full dynamics of matter, we need basically conservation of energy, or the generalization of conservation of energy to a curved space-time. Okay, and that equation is just called conservation of stress energy, creatively called because this thing T mu nu is the stress energy tensor. Okay, and that equation again, it's some equation for the components of tensors, is given by this, where this object you'll learn about is the generalization of derivatives for tensors, or something called the covariant derivative. Okay, so if I have Einstein's equations and I have some combination of these things, then I can basically tell you everything about matter, how geometry makes matter move, how matter makes geometry curve, and all that. Okay, so if we understand these equations, we can basically do anything we want. So what kind of cool things can we do? Okay, so of course, let's just make a laundry list of cool objects that you can describe using Einstein's equations. Of course, black holes are like the coolest object in physics. So you can describe black holes by Einstein's equations. You can describe the whole universe by Einstein's equations. That's also pretty cool. So maybe I'll talk about that for just a second, because my research area is cosmology. So what do I mean by the whole universe? So it turns out that these equations, plus some assumptions about the matter that live in the universe, can describe everything. So by the whole universe, I mean some idea about what kind of matter content we have. So right now, we think that if we draw a pie chart of what the universe is filled with, there's this term lambda in the equation, and that's known as the cosmological constant. And the cosmological constant you can think of as a non-diluting fluid that fills the universe, so that if the universe expands, which you might have heard that it does, it doesn't dilute. So the energy density of the cosmological constant is always a constant, hence the name, the cosmological constant. So we think that lambda is roughly 70-ish percent. And actually, I should just gloat and advertise, although I don't remember the error bars or the actual number. With the Planck satellite, which measures the cosmic microwave background radiation, we know these numbers at the percent level. So, 70 point something plus or minus 0.0 something. Okay, so it's really precision, which is fantastic. The other piece of the pie here, we've got dark matter, and that's probably about 26%. And then about 4% of the universe is atoms and the stuff we love. Actually, we love all this stuff, but we can't see it directly. Hence, it's dark. So atoms, meaning everything we're made of, light, all the stuff that we interact with is just 4% of the universe. So if we stick T mu nu with this stuff in it into Einstein's equations, then this is going to tell us basically how the universe expands with time, okay? And lambda has this peculiar property of causing the universe to expand at an accelerating rate, and we observe that, hence we infer the presence of lambda. Okay? So in cosmology, the name of the game is basically assume something about T mu nu, stick it into Einstein's equations with some assumptions that the universe is more or less homogeneous and isotropic, and then it will tell you how the universe expands. Okay? So in that sense, Einstein's equation tell you about the whole universe. Okay, you can do even better. So if you put little inhomogeneities in the beginning into the universe and you expect them then to grow under the collapse of gravity, you can not only explain you know, sort of the overall expansion rate of the universe, but you can explain how galaxies grow. You can explain basically everything we know about the universe. And amazingly, you can do that in terms of Einstein's equations in the context of a model creatively called lambda CDM. So lambda means that piece of the pie. CDM stands for cold, dark matter. That means that piece of the pie. So the name of the model is just what's in the pie, what's the universe made out of. And in the context of this model, lambda CDM, which has six parameters, you can describe basically everything we know about the whole universe. So the six-parameter model in terms of Einstein's equations tells you about everything we know. I think that's pretty cool. Okay, so you can describe black holes, you can describe the whole universe. And I guess I could go on for the rest of the hour I have talking about all the cool things you could describe using Einstein's equation. But maybe I'll stop there. So before I go on and talk about more practical-minded things, does anyone have any questions about, I don't know, the big picture or burning questions you always wanted to know about dark matter, dark energy, black holes? Okay. Great. So you'll have them, I hope, by the end of the four lectures. And by the way, I should say you can interrupt me at any time to ask me any question. So just raise your hand. Okay, so that's kind of a broad brush picture. But to get to all of that cool stuff, we need to understand first how we're supposed to think about space and time. Okay, so for the rest of today, I'm probably going to talk mostly about special relativity. I'm going to talk about, perhaps, if I get into it, the definition of tensors, and we can start unpacking that equation. But for right now, let's talk about how to think about space and time. So let's start in the old times, and let's remember how Newton taught us to think about space and time. So we're probably going to draw a lot of space-time diagrams. Picture is worth 1,000 words. It's really nice to get used to how to draw these pictures. And typically, space-time diagrams are populated by a few objects. Okay, so an important object is an event. Okay, so that's like a firecracker or, I don't know, an expletive or, you know, whatever you want. It's just some event. So there's some event, and we need someone around to observe that event. So we'll introduce an observer, and an observer follows what's known as a world line. And that's basically just a trajectory through space-time that this observer traces out. So let's say I have some observer, and at some time, we'll call that time t0, our observer sees some event. So he passes by a firecracker that explodes. So let's say I have, I don't know, some other event. We'll call that event B. That's another firecracker. And that event happens simultaneously with event A. Okay. So now let's say I consider another observer. Let's say this one is traveling at some constant velocity. Who can tell me what time observer 2 will see event A happen at, according to Newton?
According to Newton, the same time.
Yeah, t0, okay? And who can tell me whether or not observer 2 will see event A and B being simultaneous? Yes or no? Will observer 2 see event A and event B happen simultaneously, according to Newton?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Okay, so Newton says time is absolute. Right? Space and time are therefore separate. And events that are simultaneous in one frame are always simultaneous. Okay, so Newton kind of splits up space and time. And that's the name of the game. So we can talk a little bit more in detail about, you know, how these two observers would describe things a little bit differently. Okay, so so what I can do is I can perform a coordinate transformation. To go into a frame where observer one is moving, but observer two is at rest. Okay, so observer two is traveling at a constant velocity. And that means I can always just run with observer two and go to his frame, right? Go to his rest frame. Okay, so we could define some other frame, which we'll say is described by t prime and x prime. And here we have our event A, and that still happens at time t naught, right? Because we decided that nothing really special happens to the time. And now I have observer 2 and observer 1. So in this frame, observer 2 is just standing still and observer 1 is going the other direction. And the way that we describe this coordinate transformation, nothing happens to t, right? We decided t is just absolute, time is absolute. But x gets transformed like x minus vt, okay? So this is the coordinate transformation that would take us from this first frame to this second frame, okay? And this has a name, so has a name associated with someone even older than Newton. Okay, this is a Galilean transformation. And Newton's space and time are invariant under Galilean transformations. And a Galilean transformation is just this. It's just keep t fixed and change frames by just changing this vt term, right? That's basically what I can do. And so so the quantities, like if I had two events, right? Let's put our event B back on the board. Okay, these events can be separated in space. So we'll call that delta r. And in time, sorry, I picked them simultaneous, so that one's kind of boring, but we'll put it here anyway. So Galilean transformations tell us that the quantity delta t, which is just the difference in time between these two events, and delta r, which is the distance, well, that one you know how to define, so that's just the Pythagorean theorem in general. Okay, so these two quantities are the invariants, okay? So I can do any Galilean transformation I want, and it's not going to screw that up. So maybe I'll just put up here real quick also. The other thing is the transformation law for velocities, right? So we know that v prime, the primed velocity, we can define how that works. That's just defined as dx prime dt prime, which is really dx prime dt, because t is the same as t prime. And then I can use the formula I have up there and conclude that the velocity just goes dx dt minus v. So it's the velocity in the unprimed frame minus v. And that's how velocities transform. So velocities, according to Newton, they just add in a very straightforward way. Okay, so that's the world according to Newton. Basically, all you need to assume is that any shift in coordinates that I want is invariant under these Galilean transformations. And that, in a sense, defines the Newtonian view of space and time, is invariance under these Galilean transformations. Okay, so you've done Newton, and you've probably done Einstein before, I guess, but let's talk about Einstein. Okay, so a la Einstein, the way to think about space and time, of course, is to assume that the speed of propagation is a constant. So the speed of light is constant. And you can see automatically that this rule right here is not going to work, right? So if I have a velocity addition law where they just directly add, and I have a light beam, then it seems like I should just be able to run fast enough and catch up to that light beam, right? Make its velocity zero. That doesn't work. That contradicts this assumption. So what we have to do is we basically have to give up on this idea that Newton had that we can split space and time. Okay, so time will no longer be absolute. And we have to assume that something else is going to be invariant. Okay, so assuming that delta t and delta r squared are invariant will not work. Instead, I have to invent something which we'll call the space-time interval. And that will be our new invariant. Okay, so the space-time interval for now, and later we will change the letter that we use from a delta to a d. So this is the space-time interval, and it's defined as c squared delta t squared plus delta x squared delta y squared delta z squared. So now the invariant no longer splits. I no longer have two invariants, one for space and one for time. I just have one invariant that involves both space and time. And the idea is that if this thing is held invariant, then we're all good. Then the speed of light will be constant in any frame that I want. Okay. So take my word for it for now, and we'll try and unpack that statement as we go. So you might have heard that what corresponds to mixing up this space-time interval, or what corresponds to this change of frames, this coordinate transformation, is called a Lorentz transformation. Okay, so if I want to change inertial frames, that amounts to doing a Lorentz transformation. I guess I never defined an inertial frame. An inertial frame is just one in which there's an absence of forces. So two frames that are related by a constant velocity, for example, those would be two inertial frames. So if I want to change inertial frames, then I perform a Lorentz transformation. So an example. So if we did this example, okay. So if we had a constant velocity between two observers in the x direction, then the correct rule for changing x and t is given as follows. So if we want to go to the primed frame, then that's how we define t prime. where gamma is 1 minus v over c squared. Okay, and v is the relative velocity between the two frames. X prime is gamma x minus vt, and y and z don't change. Okay, so that's an example of a Lorentz transformation. I'm sure you've seen this before in a modern physics class. And you can notice the basic thing, right, which is that now t and x mix, right? So for Galilean transformations, t and x always stayed separate. But here, the time and space coordinates kind of mix up. So there's a picture you should keep in mind, which tells you exactly everything you want to know about how the time and space coordinates mix up, and you will never have to remember ever again if there is time contraction or dilation, or length contraction, like which is which. If you remember this picture, you'll never have to think about that again. Okay, so I told you that the space-time interval here is the thing that remains invariant. So let's draw lines of constant space-time interval in the tx plane. Okay, so if I have delta s squared equals 0, then those are just 45 degree lines that run through the origin, right? Let's draw that first. Okay, so these are lines on which the space-time interval is 0. And who can tell me what travels along these lines?
Light.
Light, yeah, good. So for a 0 interval, these are known as null rays. And of course, those are the rays along which light travels. So now we have a choice to draw the other lines, because here this object is squared, and I have to take a square root if I want to, say, figure out what t in terms of x is. So filling the top light cone and the bottom light cone will be hyperbolae. Okay, so these will be hyperbolae that fit nicely within this top light cone and the bottom light cone. And as I go up here, I go to bigger delta s squared. And if I go down here, I go to bigger delta s squared. Bigger magnitude, I suppose. Okay, so if I go along these hyperbolae, I get to bigger and bigger delta s squared. And then I can fill the left and right-hand quadrants here also with lines of constant delta s squared. And as I go further along the negative axis, I get to bigger magnitudes of delta s squared. As I go further to the right, I get to bigger magnitudes of delta s squared. So there's some terminology associated with these lines that we should go through. So the first thing you already knew, these are null lines. Okay, because those are the lines on which light travels. These hyperbolae that foliate the top and bottom quadrants, would these be time-like or space-like? Who can tell me? Time? No, space-like. So they are space-like because they, if you look at them, delta S squared along these lines is going to be positive, okay? So if delta S squared is bigger than 0, if delta S, bigger than 0, then these are going to be called space-like. And you can think about that because if I move along these surfaces, you can see I'm mostly moving in space. Okay? So these are space-like hypersurfaces. So these ones are the other option. These are time-like. And for these ones, along these lines, delta S squared will be less than 0. And they're time-like because as I move along this line, I'm mostly moving in the time direction. So in general, if I carve up a space, time, into space and time, I can carve it up into a set of space-like and time-like hypersurfaces. And you'll see many much more complicated examples of that, but if you remember this diagram, you never have to think about it. Okay, so now using this picture, we can ask what happens when I change frames. So if I change frames, really all I'm doing is I'm moving along these lines of constant delta S squared. That's really all I can do. So as I change frames, I kind of flow along these hypersurfaces. So if I now want to ask about two events, or I don't know, maybe I have a bar moving through space-time and I want to know how that bar gets stretched out or changes in a different frame, we can just draw pictures. So let's draw some pictures just to get a feel for how this works. Okay, so let's say I had a bar moving, just sitting here. Okay. If I have a bar just sitting here, then it just has a fixed delta x, and as delta t goes forward, it doesn't do anything, right? So in this frame, that's what my bar looks like. So now I want to go to the primed frame, which is moving at a constant velocity with respect to this one. I can ask what happens by asking how these lines move along these hyperbolae. So let's draw some of these hyperbolae. Let's pick these two. And so we can look on this hyperbole. So I've got these four points. And now as I boost to this other frame, I know that these four points, they're only allowed to move along this hyperbola. Yeah. So we could draw these same two hyperbola. I guess I drew a slightly misleading picture here, because really if I boost in one direction, everything goes the same direction. Please ignore that. So now I have these two points, and they're forced to move along these hyperbolae in that way. So if I were to draw out my bar now, it would look something like this. Okay. And if I imagine just keep doing this, make it highly boosted, you can sort of see what happens. So first of all, what's the first thing we notice is that if I call these four points events, certainly in this new frame, you can see the events are no longer simultaneous. Okay. So we lose that. We knew we were going to lose that because space and time are no longer absolute. So there's no more simultaneity. And the other thing is that you'll notice that as I do this, if I move along the hyperboloids, things are going to get stretched out in the time-like direction, right? So from here, we see we certainly expect to get time dilation, okay? Not the other way around, and that's just a consequence of the stretching on this picture. And then, in addition, we're going to get length contraction. And that comes about because as I go further and further up this hyperbola, these points will actually get closer in terms of x. So that's length contraction. Okay, so I really like this because I think in pictures. And if I remember this picture, I never have to get confused about which way the Lorentz transformation goes and which sign goes where. Really, everything you need to know is in that picture. So if you're also a pictorial learner, you might find that helpful. Okay, and you can see also clearly from doing this sort of what the difference between Newton and Einstein is. You know, sort of, if we were to draw a picture, here's another picture that I recommend you just remember. So if I start with a box, and I change frames, Newton tells me that this box remains the same length in time and it just shifts. Okay, so here's what Newton says that box is. Einstein will tell you, no, that's not right. If I trace these boundaries, in fact, what will happen is that first of all, those points are no longer at the same time. X gets squished and T gets stretched. Okay, so if you make a T-shirt, I recommend it. Let's make T-shirts. So it should just have two boxes, right? I'm Newton and I'm Einstein, and then you'll remember forever. Okay, so that's the picture, right? That's the difference between Newton and Einstein. So now let's get mathematical. If you're a pictorial learner like me, that's probably pretty good enough. But of course, if we want to do equations and whatnot, we need to know the math. So the way to write Einstein's equations, you know, typically in the Newton world, what we're used to is we usually have t and some vector. So what do you think Einstein says to do? Smush them together, right? So we smushed everything together in the space-time interval. And so the natural way to describe quantities is not going to be in terms of three vectors, but in terms of four vectors. So the position four vector is c times time, x, y, z. Okay. So those are the components of the four vector. We just add another entry in the beginning, and that's going to be t. Why do I have to put a c here? Who can tell me?
Dimensions.
Thank you. So we put c here because we've got units of length, and we want to make this consistent. Very good. So that's a four vector. We also have other quantities. So another quantity that we need to worry about, again, related to this invariant interval, is something known as the line element. So I've got delta S squared. And we'll talk about this in greater detail, technically, what these different terms mean. But that's a number. It's a real number, so it's a scalar. It's a so-called scalar quantity. So also, you see in the invariant interval, I have these distances between points, right? So here I've got stuff that's related to like two four vectors. And somehow I need to paste two four vectors together in order to get a scalar quantity. So the object that does that is something called a tensor. Okay, so this is the first time we meet tensors. So we'll denote eta mu nu. This is also called the line element. This is also called the metric. And that's going to be the thing that pastes together two four vectors into a scalar quantity. So in case you're not in the know, you'll notice we have a mu upstairs and a mu downstairs. And so that really means to sum these quantities. Yeah. So whenever I have a repeated index, that means sum them. In this case, we sum between 0 and 4, 0 and 3, excuse me. 0 will be time, 1, 2, 3 will be x, y, z. Okay, so now we could also write this in a different way, which is sometimes convenient, in terms of matrices. So we could define a vector delta x. We could define a matrix eta. And that matrix eta is just going to be, in this case, a 4x4 matrix. Okay, so if we're going to define these vectors, so we've got CT x, y, z. The T is transpose. Okay, and this matrix that gives me the right multiplication to reproduce the line element is just negative 1 in the first index and 1, 1, 1 everywhere else. Okay, you've probably run into this before. Sometimes people write 1, negative 1, negative 1, negative 1. Okay, and that's life. So roughly 50% of physicists will write it one way and 50% will write it the other way. Typically, particle physicists like to have more minus signs because they're more negative people. Typically, cosmologists like to have more plus signs because they're very optimistic. Okay, so that's kind of how it goes, right? So if I multiply that out, I guess I should have put deltas on all those t's and x's and y's and z's. I will get what I expect. Which is that. Okay. So it's our choice. We can either use this summation notation, we can use the matrices, it's kind of whatever is easier. Either way works. I guess maybe I should pause now. Are there any questions? You guys have been really quiet. You know all this? You've seen all this? Yeah? Okay. Okay. So now let's come back to this question of Lorentz transformations. I guess it's not really a question, it's a thing. Let's talk about Lorentz transformations again. So remember the Galilean transformations were the ones that left the different quantities invariant. So now we can show explicitly that Lorentz transformations leave the line interval invariant. So you can define a Lorentz transformation as a linear operation on these position four vectors that leaves the line element invariant. Okay, so it's some linear operator that I can apply to a position four vector, and it has the property that delta S squared remains invariant. So we can write that in terms of the component notation. We'll give that a prime. Is this, where this guy here, this is basically our Lorentz transformation, some linear operator. And of course, I could write this in terms of a vector notation, or a matrix notation. It would look something like that. So in this case, it would be a 4x4 matrix that multiplies that vector to give me another vector. Okay, so that's a definition. And now we can just try and understand what kind of properties that this operator has to have in order for delta S squared to be remain invariant. So we have delta S squared. We'll use the matrix notation. That's probably the easiest to work with at the moment. So let's start in the primed frame, and then we can go to the unprimed frame. So we know how to do that. We just basically hit x with a lambda. So we'll get a delta x transpose, lambda transpose. When I do the transpose, I got to flip the order. You might remember that from linear algebra. And then I've got eta lambda delta x. And the claim is that this is invariant. So what we want to know is, does this equal delta x transpose eta delta x? And you can see the condition for that to be true is that we need lambda transpose eta lambda equals eta. Okay, so Lorentz transformations are basically the set of all transformations that preserve this identity. And you might not remember, but I guarantee you've seen matrices that do this before. the rotation matrices. So let's do a little aside and just remind ourselves how that worked. Okay, so in classical mechanics, let's say I had two-dimensional space, okay? I mean space, not space-time, because now we're back in the world of Newton. So the rotation matrices in two dimensions are defined as we have cosine theta, negative sine theta, cosine theta. And these basically tell us, oh my god, that is like magic. I swear I didn't plan that. Okay, looks like you saw that this morning. right there. That's really miraculous. So this matrix will take this frame and rotate it by an angle theta. Yeah. A property of the rotation matrices, if you take R transpose times the identity matrix times R, then because R transpose for the rotation matrices equals R inverse, and the identity matrix operating on R just gives me R, this is R inverse R, which is just the identity matrix. Okay, so nothing happens, right? So if I do R transpose I R, nothing happens. So that is the same as this, because if I were to unpack the part of eta that I care about, it's basically just 1, 1 on the diagonals, the identity matrix. So this is the same thing as demanding lambda I, lambda transpose identity lambda is equal to identity. Okay, direct upshot of this, rotations should be included in their Lorentz transformations, right? This is one of the things that preserves this identity. And I'm out of board, so I gotta go over here. Okay, so rotations are one thing that preserve the line interval. And so they should be included in the set of Lorentz transformations. Actually, I'll leave this just for 1 second, because that's what I'll talk about next. So if we were to implement that, if I want a rotation along this direction, then basically I would just take this 2x2 piece and that would be a linear operation that would rotate my coordinates by an angle theta in the xy plane, right? And that would be a valid Lorentz transformation. Okay, so we have rotations. And here on the board, I had another set of linear operations, which I could just translate into this matrix notation. And those should also be considered as part of the Lorentz transformations, right? And those are known as boosts. So if I were to translate that thing there into a linear operator, then what I would get would be gamma negative v gamma 0, 0, negative v gamma gamma 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1. Okay, and you can check that. So if I hit x with this, I should get what I have for x prime on the other side of the board. And these are known as boosts. Okay? So a boost is a change of the inertial frame. So Lorentz transformations in the restricted Lorentz group, okay? So this sort of restricted set of linear operations that preserve the line interval include rotations and boosts. And you might also learn in your AM class, the earlier AM class, that you can also add translations of coordinates, So just x plus a constant or t plus a constant. You could add parity, like t goes to minus t or x goes to minus x. And when you sum all those things together with rotations and boosts, you get something bigger called the Poincaré group. So the Lorentz group basically just includes these things, but the Poincaré group includes all the other sort of standard operations you're used to for linear operations on coordinates. Okay, so that's the Lorentz group. Okay, we've proven that these linear operations keep the line interval constant. I guess in kind of a cheater way, because we just define them such, but sure, we proved that by definition. And so now if we think about these linear operations and we use this property over here, there are other things that can remain invariant. Okay, in fact, any scalar quantity should be Lorentz invariant. Okay, so really any scalar quantity you can come up with is the Lorentz, is the so-called Lorentz invariant. And these are very important because I can choose any frame I want to work in, any frame that makes the calculation easy. As long as I calculate a Lorentz invariant, it's good in any other frame. Okay, so you can save yourself a lot of work by using Lorentz invariants. So what's an example? And this allows me to introduce another object, which is the four momentum. So this is P mu. It's energy over C in the first entry, and then just the x, y, z components of momentum, just the spatial momentum that you're used to from Newtonian mechanics. And if I take eta and I hit it with two p's now, okay, so again, this is a Lorentz invariant because p transpose eta p is, we'll put a prime on it, it is just by the same derivation that we did over there for x equal to p transpose eta p. Okay, so there's no difference in what frame I work in. So this Lorentz invariant, we give it a name. So this is the rest mass. Okay, so if I look at p squared, this is a Lorentz invariant, and it's basically the rest mass, say, of a particle. So just, again, practice working with these things, but something you've probably seen before. If the rest mass is zero, okay, that's a particle like a photon. See, we expect it to travel at the speed of light. And so in this case, p mu, p nu acting on eta mu nu gives me zero. And in analogy with the picture we drew up there, these particles will travel on null lines. Okay, so in this case, the momentum, the normalization of the momentum is zero, and that implies that these particles will travel on null lines. You can be more careful about that and find the equation of motion and discover that they travel on null lines, but in fact, it's enough to just ask what the normalization of the momentum is. Okay, so you can do this with many, many quantities. In fact, most of the name of the game of relativistic mechanics is identifying Lorentz invariants, or smushing together objects into four vectors in such a way that you can get the same number of indices on the left-hand side of the equation as the right-hand side of the equation, which means you can find Lorentz invariants, and then hence it's a good thing to do. So very useful. You'll see them again and again. So I'll just also mention that Lorentz transformations are really a restricted coordinate transformation. And you can see that from the picture above. Really, all I was doing there is changing what I mean by x and t. Okay? So Lorentz transformations are just a coordinate transformation. And I can think of a more general coordinate transformation. In fact, the most general coordinate transformation can also be thought of as a linear operation. So the most general coordinate transformation is just to have x prime as a function of x and multiply by this linear operator here, which is just the matrix of partial derivatives of x mu prime with respect to x mu. And that is the most general coordinate transformation you can imagine. It includes all the Lorentz transformations, but it also includes things that would bring you to a non-inertial frame, like one in which you'd perceive there to be acceleration or anything else. So this is the most general coordinate transformation that I can write down, and it's also a linear operation. As another aside, we're talking about special relativity, but in about 2 minutes, we're going to talk about general relativity. And one of the most important parts about general relativity is that it claims, or one of the central postulates, is that it claims that physics, the laws of physics, should be invariant of the coordinate system that I used to describe them. Okay? And this is general coordinate invariance. It's also called diffeomorphism invariance. And basically what it means is that the laws of physics are invariant under this linear operation, this most general linear operation. So just like the Newtonian mechanics were invariant under the Galilean transformations, special relativity is invariant under the Lorentz transformations. In general relativity, we get even bigger, and we say, no, in fact, the laws of physics, anything I care about, should be invariant under the most general coordinate transformation, which is this guy here. Okay. Okay, so that was just a brief review of special relativity. We're about to leave special relativity for tensors and a little bit more mathy stuff. So before we go there, does anyone have any questions? No? Okay, you'll get more practice in the tutorial tomorrow doing some reviewing some computations in special relativity. So you'll have a chance to revisit this there. And if you do have any questions, please let me or one of the fellows know. Okay, let's talk tensors. So you've already seen some, secretly. So these four vectors and eta mu nu, these are components of objects called tensors. Okay, and this property of coordinate invariance basically encapsulates the fact that tensors are geometrical quantities. Okay, they are things that should not depend on what coordinate system we use. So why do I need tensors? So again, we'll go back to Newton. So if I have some vector v in the xy plane, then there's no penalty for changing my coordinate system by moving that vector around. And I can move that vector around at will. I can put it over here, I can put it over here, I can put it over here. As long as it points in the same direction, it does not matter, right? And I can always push it back. And it's totally straightforward for me to just move my drawing up there, and now it's at the origin again. No problem. So the vectors sort of get moved around at will. So what if I do a nasty trick, and instead of having the flat plane, I have a world which is a sphere, oh, like our Earth. Okay, so I'm on the Earth, and I've got vectors. And I'm only allowed to stay on the Earth. I don't have a spaceship, right? So now, if I have a vector, and it's pointing in this direction, for example, I want to move this vector around. So there's two of us, me and one of you. And I take the most direct route up here to the North Pole. And so when I get to the North Pole, this vector will curve around with me, and it will be pointing, excuse my drawing skills, it will, that looks like it's pointing straight up, so maybe I'll draw it a little bit more. Let's try better art skills. All right, I get to the North Pole, and let's say it's pointing in this direction. This is really hard to draw. Okay, so now one of you comes along, and you're like, no, I'm going to go to the other side of the Earth first. So I'm going to walk around here to the antipodal point. And now I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to walk up to the North Pole. So when I get there, my vector will be pointing in that direction. So as long as I walk around the pole, OK, it's pointing in the same direction, pointing in the same direction. But then I walk up on the top, and then it curves. Okay. So it's no longer really true that in a straightforward way, I can just move vectors around at will. Right? Something happens. If I move around the Earth, you and I will not agree on the direction of this vector. And so we need to do something about that. Okay? And so a whole branch of mathematics called differential geometry, which you're here to learn about, was invented to do things like this. Okay? So we need to come up with a way to push things around. We need to come up with a more coordinate invariant way to describe vectors. And those are tensors in general. OK, so what will follow will largely be a set of definitions without proof, because I have four lectures and I need to explain and teach you a lot of things. You'll probably revisit a lot of these concepts in either relativity or maybe even some of the other front-end courses. But I'll just give you the basics. So we'll start with a set of concepts. So the first concept is to, again, take our sphere, and let's pick a point somewhere. Okay, let's say at the North Pole. So what we can do is we can define a plane that is tangent to the North Pole. Imagine that's actually tangent, even though it doesn't seem like it from my poor drawing skills. And we can imagine from this point constructing all possible unit vectors defined in the normal sense, just x hat, y hat, z hat, tilted by an angle, x hat, y hat, z hat, tilted by an angle, et cetera, et cetera. So just the set of all possible vectors emanating from this point, which we will call P. So we define TP. This is tangent space at P. And this is just all vectors that I construct at a point P. So this tangent space, it's a space because it's what is known as a vector space. So TP is a vector space. And so a vector space is basically something it's a collection of objects. It's a collection of vectors that satisfy a certain set of properties that will seem totally boring to you because most of the things we know and love satisfy these properties, but just for completeness. So it has to be linear. And by linear, I mean if I take two real numbers, and I multiply them by two vectors, I have to get what I'd expect I'd get, which is AV, BV plus AW, BW. So you can see a few things from this equation. So first of all, we just basically have scalars multiplying the vectors. That's an allowed operation. We can add vectors. That's an allowed operation. And this thing should be completely equal to VA plus VB plus WA plus WB. So there's some degree of associativity and so on and so forth. So basically, everything should be linear in this sense. Okay? And if it is that, we have a vector space. Number two, there has to be such a thing as zero. Okay, so there's a zero vector. And possibly, there is an inner product, or there's some way of defining the angle between two vectors. Okay. So we've seen that a few times. This would be perhaps something like the dot product that we're used to. Another thing that would define an inner product would be, for example, the metric tensor, the line element. So this would define an inner product, and so on and so forth. So if something satisfies, some collection of objects satisfies these three properties, you can rightfully call it a vector space. And that can be something that's very concrete, like XYZ spatial vectors. It can also be something that's very abstract, like a state space. So in quantum mechanics, you have a Hilbert space. This is a state vector that points in some abstract state space, and that would be considered a vector space as well. Question?
So the definition requires having a metric on the manifold sphere?
Only if you require an inner product, and that's possibly. So there are many things that don't have an inner product, but still would be considered a vector space.
Okay.
Everything we care about will have that property. Yeah. But you might find other examples where you don't. Okay, so that's a vector space, and every point in space has a tangent space with which I can associate a vector space. Well, a tangent space is a vector space. So now, just star a vector field is basically just the collection of all tangent spaces. So this is all the vectors at all points. Okay, and you can think that this is kind of the most general object that I need to figure out how to make vectors move between different points, right? Okay, so kind of obvious that this should be part of our theory of differential geometry. Yeah?
The tangent space at any point is just like R2.
It depends on the dimension of the manifold, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So, but then if I've got like a collection of all tangent spaces, mm-hmm. is this also preserving the orientation of the points, like the pointing on your in this case on the sphere?
So I don't know yet, because really right now I have this most general thing, which is the collection of all vectors at all points. I don't really have a rule yet for gluing a particular vector at one point to another vector at a different
right.
point. And that will come later.
Okay.
Yeah. So for right now, we're just thinking, what kind of objects do we need? So just in a very abstract sense. Okay. So the next thing. Let's get a little bit more specific, and let's think in terms of a basis, right? So if you like. Instead of every vector in the world, I can now consider x hat, y hat, z hat times an arbitrary real number, right? So I can define a basis, and that makes our life a little bit more concrete. Okay, so these are basically linearly independent elements that span a vector space. And notice how I said vector space and not a vector field, because it's perfectly allowed for your basis to change at each point. Totally fine. So in general, we usually don't do that in Newtonian mechanics, but sure, you can do that. Your basis can change. Okay, so here, now we'll just introduce a set of notation. So if I have a quantity with no indices, this is going to be a vector. And a vector has components. And a vector has basis elements. In a simple example, this is just a really fancy way of writing, for example, in flat three-dimensional space, this could be 1 x hat plus 2 y hat plus 3 z hat, right? Where the x hat, y hat, z hat are my basis elements, and the 1, 2, 3 are my components. So that's a vector. Now the claim is that a vector is a geometrical object that's completely independent of whatever coordinate system that I want to work in. Okay, so we kind of know what it takes to do this. So so let's, again, we can define how our vector's components transform. So we've already done this. So let's just conjecture that this is indeed the way that A transforms. Okay, so I perform a linear operation. And that could be the Lorentz transformation, or that could be the general coordinate transformation we talked about before. Let's make it the most general thing. Okay, so I have some general coordinate transformation. And if I demand that A is invariant, then I can learn something about how my coordinates transform, or my basis vectors transform, excuse me. So if I have A, that was nasty. I shouldn't have put a prime there, because A is not dependent on my coordinate system. Right, so A is an invariant object. So I can have A nu prime, for example, E hat nu prime. And I can ask how this now has to work. So so here I have A mu, A nu prime mu, E hat nu prime. Okay, so I know that this basically has to be what the basis element would be in the unprime frame. So I did one thing here. Sorry, I called two things A, which is I switched the order, right? So unless I'm working with matrices, I'm totally allowed to do that. If it's written in components, you can switch the order of anything you like. If you write it in terms of matrices, user beware. Okay, that's never a kosher thing to do. Also, a good aside, so while I'm talking about moving things around, you'll notice that whenever I had one upper and one lower index, I was very careful to not put them directly above each other or below each other, right? And that is because, in general, it is not true that lambda mu nu is equal to lambda nu mu. No, bad. Okay, so. So whenever you see these upper and lower indices, just as a little aside, be really careful to not screw up the fact that they're not right on top of each other. Because if you put them on top of each other, you won't know who comes first. And that's bad. Why? Because these are matrices, right? So if I flipped the ordering of rows and columns in a matrix, I wouldn't get the same matrix in general. Okay, so so here in general, this is going to be have to give me E hat mu. So we can actually learn something from this. So So if that's going to be e hat mu, then I should be able to see how this guy has to transform to get me that. So here we have e hat mu. That should be equal to lambda nu prime mu e hat nu prime. And if I define the transformation law for this guy to be as follows. I need to be a little careful. Actually, I don't want to do that, do I? Okay, aside, because I'm confusing myself here, you should know about dummy indices. So what are dummy indices? Who knows what dummy indices are? Besides me making a really boneheaded mistake in my derivation. Yeah?
Indices you're summing over?
Exactly. So this nu prime here is summed, right? That means I can screw with that any way I want. I can make that rho or gamma or delta or whatever I want, as opposed to this index, which you see matches an index on the left-hand side of the equation. So leave that one alone. So that one is a so-called dummy index. So what I want to do here is just change indices to be extra careful. This is a general rule. If you want to be extra careful, you can always replace indices. And in fact, I highly encourage you to replace indices when they're summed over and you do some substitution in an equation. Because then you don't lose track of who's a dummy and who's not. Okay, so so here we have this going on, okay, and the nu prime index that was summed over. So now I've made another mistake, which is there's a mu up there, so I should get rid of that, and I need to. Yeah. Again, I'm making a dummy mistake. Okay, so I have one guy here, and that's going to have to do with here we've got unprimed coordinates, and here we've got primed coordinates. So if I make a definition, and my definition is just that here you can see I've got a prime coordinate downstairs and a prime coordinate upstairs. And here I've got an unprimed coordinate upstairs and an unprimed coordinate downstairs. If I conjecture that this is just delta, which is 1 for rho equals mu and 0 for rho not equals mu, then I can make this equality. Okay, so this was just a definition, but what this did for us is it defined the inverse of this coordinate transformation. And that was what that long-winded thing was meant to do. So now I have an inverse for this coordinate transformation. And it's really just defined by this equality, that this product of these two matrices equals the delta function. So now I can perform coordinate transformations from the primed to the unprimed frame. But I can also go backwards from the unprimed frame to the primed frame. With that definition. Okay, so here we see that the basis elements, they transform. With this definition, the components of the vector transform. And with this definition, the basis elements transform. And they transform in just such a way that the product is constant. Okay, so A, if we make this definition, is a coordinate invariant quantity called a vector. So I think I'm out of time. I will continue tomorrow with the dark side of vectors, which are dual vectors. You can interact with vectors in a different way. And then we'll talk more about tensors and whatnot. But before we leave, are there any questions?
When you told that we have to take care not to, keep the two indices on top of each other. I was just wondering, you said when we are writing in that other order, that's like flipping the rows and columns.
Right.
And what if I flipped mu with mu and mu with mu? What would that be then?
Meaning, I've got the chalk. Let me write it. What do you mean? So you want lambda?
Mu mu.
Mu mu. Ah, very good.
New mu.
New mu. Ah, I see. Okay. Right. Yeah, so this would be, this would be like flipping the rows and the columns. You're right. And this would be a different operation, I guess, which would be more like transpose, perhaps? Homework problem.
How does that matter?
That's the same thing.
New and new could be anything. They both run from 0 to 3.
Yes, but the order of the indices has something to do with the the order of multiplication, right? So
yeah, but I can see why that is transposing. Like if you have one on top of the other and the other, like I mean that's how you'd see the inverse working, obviously.
Right.
But if you just swap new and new,
right.
If you're not contracting anything with anything, then you could call them whatever you want.
Sure. Right, I mean, I guess it depends on the context. If mu and nu have a specific identity, like nu indices I multiply by x and nu indices
exactly.
I multiply by p, then it would matter.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess the statement then would be, is this a symmetric matrix or not?
Right.
If it's a symmetric matrix, it won't make any difference, even if I screw up the identity of these things.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not a symmetric matrix, then I might care.
Yeah.
But good point. As it stands, these are abstract indices. I could call them elephant and banana,
sure.
Right? So it doesn't matter. Yeah. Good question. Yeah.
Wouldn't the other one differ if the metric was more general than the Minkowski? Isn't
absolutely.
That the difference?
Yeah.
Then it would be multiplied, but it would still be two matrices, but with a lot of... Okay.
Yep. Yeah, so when I want to multiply things together in a general context, we'll talk about tomorrow, but that will involve the metric tensor, which will be more general than just the one we wrote down. Yep. Other questions? Nope. Okay, see you tomorrow morning.